The following podcast was recorded live at the Seattle Central Library. It was presented by the Washington Center for the Book with the Elliott Bay Book Company. Podcasts and the library's Fall Author Series are made possible through the generous support of the Seattle Public Library Foundation, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and Safeco Insurance Foundation. For more information on these podcasts, please visit our website, www.spl.org. Cliff Mass discussed his book, The Weather of the Pacific Northwest, November 15, 2008.
My name is Jody Fenton, and I'm the manager of the Hugh and Jane Ferguson Seattle Room here in the Central Library, and I'm pleased to be the co-sponsor of this program today. I'd like to welcome you all to the library. If you're not a card-carrying member, we can change that for you right out at our membership desk, and be happy to give you a great library card, which is just the best value, we think, in the city. We can't do these kinds of programs without so many other people helping us, and of course today we have the University of Washington Press to thank for all of the work that they've done in bringing this book together, and we'll hear more about the book, of course, but we have Rachel Mann and Lee Soper here from the press today, and I just would like to give them a round of applause for all the great work they do for us. And then there's someone you can't see, but his work is very important to a program like this. Chris Harmon is in our AV booth this afternoon. He'll make sure that you can all hear and that the air conditioning is all working and correct and everything is great. So we're always happy to have our event services staff here as well. And some of you have already purchased the book. This is its debut. It's hot off the press. And we're always happy to work with Elliott Bay Books, having them come and bring the books to us and to you to sign and make these events so important. And Rick is out here directing some traffic, but he'll be back in to make sure that any of you who would like a copy of this book can have it. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Cliff Mass. I know all of you listen to his radio show. There are probably graduate students and other students of his in the audience today, and that's great as well. Dr. Mass went to Cornell University, graduated in 1974 with a degree in physics, went on to get his PhD in atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington, left this region for a short period of time to teach in University of Maryland, and then finally came back to us, and we're very glad to have him back. He's published numerous articles. He's active on many important in many important organizations in this area, the American Meteorological Association, and all of the local committees associated with that. When I was trying to find out a little bit more about him, I learned that he has this great blog to encourage everybody to learn more math. And I have to say that I'm an art major, so I never really learned a lot of math, but I certainly enjoy the beauty of the clouds in some of those Frederick Church paintings that we look at. And maybe someday we'll get Dr. Mass to comment on weather in art. Maybe that would be a nice thing. At any rate, without any further ado, I'm going to turn him over to you. I know you'll have a great afternoon. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the Seattle Public Library putting this on, and Elliott Bay Books as well. No math today. Math education is one of my hobbies. Anyway, I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about the book, but more about the Northwest weather. So I think you want to hear more about the weather than you want to hear about the book. But let's start with something fun that is actually in the book. On June 24th, 1947, a pilot named Kenneth Arnold was flying a small plane between Chehalis and Yakima, and he spotted a group of saucer-like objects over Mount Rainier. And there's the guy right there. This is notes there. And that began the UFO craze. It began here, 1947, in Washington State. We could be proud of that. And during a recent presidential debate on October 30th, 2007, candidate Dennis Kucinich admitted that he saw a UFO while staying at Shirley MacLaine's home. And what do both of these sightings have in common? And I better watch out when I ask a question like that. Both of them occurred over Washington State near Mount Rainier. And Kucinich had her house in Graham, which is over here, when in 1947 he was flying across and he saw the flying saucers somewhere around here. Now, could these strange apparitions could their origin be a frequent weather feature that we often see around Mount Rainier and other major mountains of this region, something called a mountain wave cloud? And I'll let you judge. Here's an example. That's a mountain wave cloud. That is completely natural. And it does look a little bit like a UFO, you have to admit. Or how about this one? Sometimes they're stacked in the vertical. And how about that? Right? You'll start believing in UFOs by the time I get through with you, perhaps. But none of these are UFOs. These are a completely natural feature that we often see around here in the Northwest. These are mountain wave clouds. And I don't know if I have a pointer. There's the mountain, okay? You have air approaching the mountain, and what happens is the atmosphere is generally what we call stable. And that is, if you push some air up, it tends to go back down again. And often the motion is like a pendulum. Like if you get a pendulum and you pull it back and it goes back and forth. Air does the same thing. If it gets shoved up, often it'll sort of oscillate in the vertical. And that's exactly what happens. Here's the mountain, the air's coming in, and if the air is forced to, this thing is really not very good. The air is forced to rise over the mountain. I'll use the cursor here. It's forced to rise, and when the air rises, it cools. Because what happens is, when air rises, it goes to lower pressure, and the air expands. And when it expands, it cools. Now, you're all familiar with this. If you have a spray can, if you spray a spray can, right, it's cold coming out of it, right? You let the air out of a tire, it's cold. When the air expands, it cools. And if it can cool enough, it can saturate, and you can get clouds and precipitation. The reason it saturates is cold air can hold less moisture than warm air. And so if you have air that's, you know, it's not saturated and it cools down, it can hold less and less water vapor and eventually it starts condensing out. But anyway, that's more detail than I need right now. What happens is the air approaches the mountains, it's forced to rise, and where is that cursor? There it is. And as it rises, you get a cloud, then it sinks on the other side, and then it rises in the downwind and up and down, producing a series of clouds. And these often have a lens shape or lenticular shape, and it looks like a flying saucer. Okay, these are mountain wave clouds. From space, you can see these frequently. This is a high-resolution satellite picture. You see the line of clouds there? That's what mountain wave clouds look like from space. So anyway, this is one example of the kind of fun thing I threw in the book, and this is a very natural phenomenon. Now, let me talk a little bit about the book before I go on to any other details here. This is my attempt to write a comprehensive book, but one that was suitable for lay people. And I threw everything I liked: big storms, big floods, local weather, convergence zones, how weather prediction is done, climate, you name it, it's in there. And it has a lot of colored illustrations and photos. So you'll see there's a lot of photographs here. Now, this is University of Washington Press subsidized this book. The Strom Foundation supported it. And so it allowed us to put a lot of color into the book. So there's pictures like this. Some cirrus stratus, and there's some nice cirrus over here on the right side, some fall streaks. Those are ice crystals falling out of some cirrus clouds. And I have all kinds of other figures all kinds of other graphics that are in there. So the book is pretty heavily illustrated. How do you like that? That's the Skokomish River. Right by the Skokomish River. That's a river that floods with almost any kind of rain due to the practices of the timber industry. Anyway, the way the book is designed, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, is I go through the introductory stuff first, you know, sort of give you the 101 stuff about the atmosphere here, and then I get into the red meat stuff people like the floods, snowstorms, and windstorms. These are my favorite, the severe weather of the Northwest. And then I sort of back off a bit, and I talk a little bit about sea breezes and land breezes, the sound breeze that comes in summer afternoons here into the sound. And then I talk about the weather of the coastal zone, like the surges that move up the coast or the sea breezes along the coastal zone here. I also talk a little bit about a crazy warm place in southern Oregon, the Banana Belt, near Brookings, Oregon, where they get really warm temperatures. Then I talk about the mountain-related weather phenomena, including this kind of stuff I just showed you about the UFOs, and about Mount St. Helens and what that eruption did and things like that. The next chapter, I talk about Squim, the rain shadow there. I talk about strange weather optical effects we get around here, mirages in the northwest. And then the final two chapters, I talk about the way weather predictions done around here. I talk a little bit about climate, and I end up giving you a little tutorial on how you read the skies around here and the clouds. Okay. Well, anyway, I just wanted to thank a few people before I start the main part of the talk. I want to thank the UW Press for doing this and the Strom Foundation for supporting it. Beth Tully did a lot of the graphics for this, a lot of the color graphics. The UW Press editor, Mary Rubesky, and the book designer. I mean, this book really is very colorful, and Ashley Salibi really did a wonderful job. And I want to thank my wife, Carolyn, who's right there, and my two kids, Nathan and Aaron, who tolerated me writing this thing over 7 years. Okay, enough about the book. Now let's talk about a little bit of Northwest Weather 101. And I'm authorized to give you this instruction because I do teach 101 at the UW. Really, there's a few basic things you have to know that explain most of what we know about Northwest weather. Number one is the effects of terrain. The weather here is dominated by terrain, and it forces many of the local weather features. So if you understand how terrain works with weather, that explains a lot about the weather in our region. So that's one thing you have to know about. This is a nicer map of the terrain, and one of the things that the terrain does is it gives us our mild climate here in the Northwest. There's fairly cold air in the interior of the continent. There's cold air in northern Canada that moves down into the central part of the United States. But that cold air can't get to us because we have a double-barreled protection. You know, we have the Rockies over here that prevent most of the cold air from getting to us, and then we have the Cascades, which is our secondary defense that prevents the really cold air from the interior of the continent from getting to us. So in cross-section, it looks like this. This is from the book. This is east-west over here. And you have the really, really cold air in the central part of the continent. Most of the cold air, thank you very much, is trapped by the Rockies. A little bit of that air is able to get across. And as it sinks down into eastern Washington, it warms. Now, you all know about this warming because when air is compressed, when air is sinking from higher levels where it's lower pressure to higher pressure at low levels, it's compressed. Compressing air warms it. And you all are familiar with this, right? If you have a bicycle pump and you're pumping up your bike, you feel it's warm, right? Compressing air warms the air. And so air that gets across the Rockies, if some cold air does get across, it's warmed up. So the air may be cold on one side and it's cool on the other. Now then we have the Cascades, which block cool air. If a little of that air gets across, by the time it sinks down into us, it sinks again and warms again. And so because of this, we can't get very cold air in general. It's very hard to get cold air here. Most of the time, our air is off the Pacific Ocean. And the Pacific Ocean is relatively mild. This figure here from the book shows you the winter and summer sea surface temperatures over the Pacific. And the bottom line of all this is the temperatures of the water surface right offshore, off of us, only get into the upper 40s. And so our weather comes off the Pacific, and so if it's coming off the Pacific, it can't get that cold because it's over this relatively warm water. And occasionally when we get air coming from the further south, you see Hawaii down there, we get a Pineapple Express, that air is really pretty warm because it's over warm water, even warmer water down there. So we have the mountains stopping the cold air from coming in, and we have a relatively warm ocean, and that produces our relatively mild climate. Well, let's talk a little bit about rain shadows. I have a lot of rain shadows in the book. The book is full of rain shadows. People are always talking about rain here in the Northwest, but I think what's perhaps more interesting is where it's not raining. There's places, a lot of places, it's not raining all the time. And these we call rain shadows. So let's talk about that. Well, probably the number one rain shadow that anybody knows around here, probably the number one question I get from people calling in from California, is about the SQUIM rain shadow. They can't believe it. Is it really, really true? There's a place in Washington State that's quite dry, west of the mountains, and that's SQUIM. This is a picture I took looking back towards the Olympic Mountains, looking towards the southwest. You know, this is during the summer, everything's dried out there. This is a place where there's cacti, natural cacti, in western Washington. All right? That's kind of hard to believe. And in fact, even the florist shops have cacti. Now, you think you were in Arizona or something. Here is a figure from the book that shows you the average annual precipitation over this part of the state. And what I want you to notice is that on one side of the Olympics, it rains like hell. I mean, we're talking about 150, 170 inches a year, and that's pretty unpleasant. And there's a rainforest there. Well, if you like rain, it's not unpleasant. But then you have the rain shadow area to the southwest, the northeast of the mountains, and there's SQUIM right there. And that rain shadow extends to northern part of Whidbey Island into the southern San Juans. But the ground zero is right around SQUIM, and probably the driest spot is right by the spit there, where they get very little rain. Average year, 15.97 inches. Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, gets 14.89. So almost the same precipitation as Los Angeles. So you can see why all these California types want to retire up here, and why there's so many golf courses in SQUIM. Now, why is there a rain shadow? Well, this, you know, I think I said some of this before, but the bottom line, if you have a mountain barrier, and you have air that's rising up the barrier, as it's forced to rise, the pressure decreases, it expands and cools. If it cools enough, you get clouds, and you can get some precipitation. But then as the air sinks down the other side over here, it warms. And as it warms, the relative humidity tends to drop, and the clouds evaporate. And so if you're living over here, that's where the rain shadow is. And you can see this on local mountains all the time. Here's an example of air going up a hill, and you get the clouds in the top, and the wind goes, and as it goes down the other side, it starts to evaporate. Well, think of the Olympics. So anyway, the reason let me just back it up here. The reason that the rain shadow tends to be centered up here is that the winds generally in the winter is from the southwest. So the winds are generally coming from the southwest. They rise on one side of the Olympics, and they sink on the northeast side. And that's why the rain shadow tends to be in SQUIM, because the winds tend to be from the southwest. Now, rain shadows can move. If the winds switch to a different direction, the rain shadow off the Olympics will switch. And in fact, that happened this week, right? Everybody knows about the heavy rain this week, some places. But some places it didn't rain almost at all. On Wednesday, the flood day, I bike to work. I bike to work most days. I live north Seattle, and there was almost no rain. I biked to work dry while it was pouring in the mountains. There was roughly 4 to 8 inches in the Cascades and on the windward side at the Olympics. But over Puget Sound, there was hardly anything. This on the left-hand side, this is a weather radar image. And I don't know if you can see the navigation of it. Here's the coast. Seattle's right there. And the yellows are the heavy precipitation. Green is moderate precipitation. And the pinks are sort of light stuff, okay? And what I want you to see is there seems to be this hole right there. I wish this thing would stay on, right there. That is the rain shadow. And what happened was the winds on the coast were almost due westerly. And so the air was sinking down right into here, producing no precipitation, while all hell was breaking loose to the south and over the mountains. Now, it was raining like hell over here, too, but we can't see it because the radar is blocked. And this is something I talk about on KOW a lot. This is one of my favorite topics. This is one of my windmills I'm tracing. There's no weather radar on the coast. And so it's all blocked here, and we can't see what's going on. The weather radar that we have in Seattle is right on Kameno Island up there. So it's raining there very hard, but we can't see it. Anyway, the rain shadow existed, and the computer models that we have now forecast it almost perfectly. This is the 24-hour rainfall over here, ending on Thursday morning, and the reds are really heavy rain, 5 to 10 inches, but almost nothing here in the rain shadow. So if you were on the Kitsap Peninsula over there, it was a pretty good day. So these are the amazing contrasts around here. And if you understand our weather, on almost any day of the year, you can get yourself into some place that's pretty dry. You can always go across the Cascades. Well, you know, one thing I want to convince you of is Seattle really isn't that wet, really, compared to the rest of the country. Seattle has typically about 38.4 inches of rain a year, and Portland has about 37.4. Does that seem like a lot? Not too bad. Compared to Houston, Texas, 46, New York, 43, 50 in Atlanta, Miami, 57. I mean, do you hear people in Miami complaining about the rain? Well, maybe you do. But actually, we get less rain than they do. We are rain-shadowed by the Olympics, Portland by the coastal mountains, and so it really isn't that bad in terms of rain. But where it goes downhill is the next two columns, unfortunately. The number of days with about a trace amount of rain, a hundredth of an inch or more, 157 for us, you know, the other guys, 101, 120, so we're the worst about that, the light stuff, right? So we don't have that much. Our rain is not that much for the year, but it's kind of, we have a lot of light stuff. And the number of cloudy days, that's when it gets really depressing. 228 and 229 for us. And that's why Miami, people go to Miami, only 117 for Miami. So that's where we get it. We have a lot of clouds and light rain. But the total rain is not that much here. Now, this is an interesting fact. You know, the Northwest has what I call a Mediterranean climate. The Mediterranean climate means it rains in the winter and it's dry in the summer. And look at it, right? This is inches over here on the left. And you see, that's up to 6 inches in total. And, you know, our winters are wet up to 5 to 6 inches. But during June and July, it's really dry. It's only an order of an inch, right? Now, contrast that to New York. People don't think of New York as being in a rainforest. They have almost the same amount of rain all year round, about 4 inches or so. Why do they have rain in the summer and we don't? What is missing here that they have? Thunderstorms. Humidity too, but we don't have thunderstorms. They get most of their rain in the summer from thunderstorms. We don't have a lot of thunderstorms, and so our rain drops down. And so, you know, we really have two seasons here. Now, I've always thought a great irony is the baseball season, we're dry, right? Football season, we're wet. So what did the city fathers do when they when they spend hundreds of millions of dollars? We spend $100 million on a roof, a movable roof on our baseball stadium, even though we play baseball in a place that is one of the driest places in the United States during the summertime. On the other hand, our football stadium doesn't have a cover, and they play in the wettest time of the year. So I don't know if there's any representatives here of the sports teams, but I don't know.
The reason is because the visiting teams cannot handle the weather.
Okay. Okay, now we got our explanation. Good. Okay. Well, enough of that. One of my great loves, you know, the big storms here in the Northwest. And we get some big storms. Our big wind storms are as big as anybody's storms. And in fact, some of our big wind storms are equivalent to Category 2 or 3 hurricanes. Now, our storms, and there's a nice picture, there's a satellite picture here. I mean, that looks pretty scary. That's the Inauguration Day windstorm of January 20th, 93. That was Bill Clinton's inauguration. Remember that? So there's not going to be any political commentary here. Anyway, there's a low center right here. And our big windstorms are associated with low pressure centers. And these are called mid-latitude cyclones. Hurricanes are tropical cyclones. Ours are mid-latitude cyclones. They're different than the tropical cyclones. Mid-latitude cyclones, their energy source is the difference in temperature between the tropics and the poles. On the other hand, the tropical cyclones, their energy source is the warm water of the tropical oceans. Anyway, this is a very complex, perhaps, but maybe not, this is a pressure analysis of the last great storm to hit Seattle, the Hanukkah Eve storm. You remember that? In December 14th, 15th, 2006. This is an 18-hour forecast from a high-resolution computer forecast model. I think you can see Washington and Oregon. Those lines are lines of constant pressure. They're called isobars. The low center is right here. And all I want you to know is if there's a lot of lines, that means there's a big change in pressure. There's very low pressure here, big pressure changes. Big pressure changes produce strong winds. And so, I don't know if you notice, see this area here with the isobars, the pressure are packed together, the pressure changes are really strong? That rotated right into us that evening. And that produced winds that, in some places, got to 70, 80 miles per hour. The next day, I got in the car and I drove out to Mercer Island. This is what I found. I know anybody here from Mercer Island? Okay, a few people. Boy, Mercer Island looked like a war zone. I couldn't even drive very far in. This is what I saw. This is a house on the east side. I think this may have been the Sammamish Plateau over here. And the reason I put that in is this storm really produced a lot of damage. And the big thing were the trees that fell. You know, people in Florida, they talk about their hurricanes, but we have a force multiplier for our windstorms, the big trees. And when they fall, they cause a lot of damage. And we had a lot of trees falling for this windstorm because the previous month had been unusually wet. Very wet soils cause the soils to lose adhesion with the roots, and you have a greater tendency for these trees to be toppled over when you have very saturated soils. And I don't know how many of you remember, but November 2006 was an extraordinarily wet November. Remember that you had those floods in Mount Rainier Park, right, that was closed for a long period of time? And so we had really saturated soils, and then we had a windstorm that was the strongest windstorm probably in 20, 30 years. However, the greatest windstorm of all, the greatest of the greats, was the October 12, 1962, the Columbus Day storm. This was probably the greatest non-tropical storm ever to hit the United States, undoubtedly the strongest to hit the West Coast. This was equivalent to a Category 3 hurricane in terms of its wind speeds. I don't know if you can see this very well, but look at some of the wind speeds, 146 plus in Cape Blanco, 138 at Newport, even in the inland areas. Portland got to 116, Renton got to 100 miles per hour. We're talking about way above hurricane force winds. And we have the trees that help knock things down. To really impress your friends, you got to go to Cape Blanco. And there they had sustained winds of 150 miles per hour with gusts to 179 before the anemometer got blown away. Now, admittedly, Cape Blanco is on a bluff. I don't know if you've ever been there. And that probably accelerated the winds a bit. But we're talking about Category 3 hurricane strength winds. I mean, we're talking about a very, very powerful storm. The last really amazing storm to hit is one that you probably remember. December 3rd, 4th, 2007. This is called the Great Coastal Gale Storm. This was the most unusual storm I've ever seen. And I've been studying these wind storms now for several years. We had hurricane force winds that lasted about 24 hours along the coast, with some places getting winds of 125, 130 miles per hour. At the same time, there was intense rainfall over the coastal mountains here of southwest Washington. You can see some of the values on here, 102, 119. It was unbelievable, the damage. Okay, this is Bay City, Oregon. This is not from trees falling. This is direct wind damage. There were whole swaths of forest that were taken out. I mean, whole sections of forest that were actually destroyed, knocked down like that. This is just isolated. This happened all over the coastal region. Look at that. That is direct wind damage. You know, we often see trees knocking down, but to have the winds destroy buildings, I mean, that doesn't happen that often around here. So that's pretty amazing. And then at the same time, while these winds were blowing on the coast, intense rain was hitting southwest Washington, as much as 20 inches of rain. And the result was flooding of the Chehalis River and Centralia. Remember the flooding of Centralia and Chehalis around there? This is I-5 was closed for almost a week. Remember that? Amazing flooding. And just to give you a little bit better picture of the geography here, the arrow shows you that the winds, the strong winds, blowing right up into the area of the dashed line, air up the mountains, giving intense rainfall. The heavy rain resulted in all kinds of landslides, which actually had effect on some political races around here. Yep, some people know about the lands commissioner, Doug Sutherland. Anyway, if this storm didn't happen, Doug Sutherland would probably still be land commissioner for the state of Washington. But the Seattle Times did a expose and suggesting that, there were some logging practices that were unfortunate, and that plus the heavy rain caused, you know, these slides that contributed to this disaster. But I'm not going to get into that now, because this is not a political talk. So here's what's so interesting about this storm. Generally, for windstorms around here, they're associated with low-pressure systems that move up the coast. Generally, the winds only last a few hours. And most windstorms don't cause flooding. Why did this event produce both of them? Well, here's a picture similar to the one I showed you before. Here's that pressure. Here's a pressure analysis for December 3rd, 2007. At this time, hurricane-force winds were on the coast, and flooding was starting to happen on the Chehalis River. Now, if you look offshore, you see a low-pressure center there? This time, a deep low-pressure center was offshore, and it stayed offshore almost without motion. Inland, there was a lot of high pressure. Between the two, there was a lot of pressure change, producing very strong winds that stayed in place for almost 24 hours. That's what those blue arrows indicate, coming right into the region. And so you had strong winds on the coast, a lot of air going up the mountains, and so you had the winds and the flooding at the same time, and the heavy rain. Really unusual storm. I'm studying this one right now. Let me end with one final topic, and then I'll open up to questions. Maybe I'll get a little controversial here. A little controversy is good, and I put it in the book, even though some people warned me not to do it, but I did. Global warming, what will be the effects here in the Pacific Northwest? Have we already seen warming? Is the snowpack melting? There are all kinds of claims you hear by certain members of the media and even by certain well-known political figures in the area. You know, one of them is that the mountain snowpack has dramatically declined over the last several decades. Some people were talking about a 50% reduction in snowpack over the Cascades. Another thing that I heard, in fact, I just heard on King 5, I should name stations, just a day or two ago, the number of heavy rain and flooding events has increased substantially, probably due to global warming. Another thing you've heard that probably is that the Northwest climate is particularly sensitive to global warming. But on the other hand, you hear some people saying, global warming is a theory that we really don't have to worry about, and there's a lot of hype going on. In fact, I have to admit, you know, there's some people who are writing books about the latter one, and that book is beating mine right now. If you go to Amazon and you see where books are and weather, there's a book that's ahead of mine, and it's staying ahead of mine. And some of the books that seem to be the most popular books are these books saying that global warming is nonsense. So right now, the number one weather book is something like Red Hot Lies, Why Global Warming is Nonsense, or something like that. Well, what I'm going to suggest that none of these things are true. Let me talk about that. There is a lot of research going on in the area of global warming. And there's very sophisticated climate models that are being used, global climate models. This is an example of one of them. I mean, these are the best technology our species can put together. This shows you the forecast change in temperature for 2100 This is basically assuming that Bush stays president or something, you know, but you know, that we don't change, okay? Again, I shouldn't do politics. And the shading indicates how much warming goes on through the century. And this, I have to apologize, it's degrees centigrade. Meteorologists like to use centigrade. Just double it roughly, and that's degrees Fahrenheit. And what I want you to see, and there's almost all the climate models indicate this, the Arctic warms up more than any other place on the planet, which makes sense, because you melt off the ice and snow, and instead of reflecting the solar rays into space, they get absorbed, okay? So the Arctic warms up more than any other place. The land warms up more than the water, right? Water warms up more slowly than land. And so the oceans warm up less. And another thing that's a little subtle in this picture is that the eastern oceans tend to warm up less than the western oceans. Now, there's been all kinds of talk about snowpack here. All this warming, and then, okay, these simulations are really quite good, but there's an interesting fact. The snowpack in the Cascades has not changed in the last 30 years. Okay, over the last 30 years, this shows you the snowpack, the amount of water in this Cascade snowpack at various levels, and basically there's some variability, but it hasn't changed. Really interesting. This is a plot of how temperature has changed over roughly the same period, from 1979 to 2008. And again, I apologize, this is degrees centigrade. But what I want you to see is that over land, the temperatures are warming up a lot. This is a very low resolution analysis. It's warming over land, but look at the water. My God, it's hardly warming up at all. But I want you to notice that the eastern ocean is not warming up much at all, but the western ocean is. So, what happens if we run very high resolution computer forecast models, and this is something my group has done, in which we try to see what the local implications of global warming is. And this shows you the change in temperature between the 1990s and certain periods. And this is between the 1990s and 2020s, but December, January, and February. Basically, over the next 20, 30 years, the temperature doesn't change that much. My 2050s, where some of the younger people will see, it's starting to warm up a bit, but it's the 2090s, wow, it's a different world. So this is the most sophisticated simulations we have right now. So the warming here seems to be slow, and then it ramps up. Here is the number of days greater than 80 degrees at SeaTac predicted. 1990s, you see there. 2020s, just slightly more. 2050s going up. 2090s, well, it's a different story, right? And this is the number of days greater than 90 degrees. So, what is happening is the following. I'm just going to back it off here. What's happening is our weather is controlled by the Pacific Ocean. And the Pacific Ocean is not warming up as quickly as the land. It turns out that global warming will be slower here than almost anywhere in the country, because we're downwind of the ocean, of an eastern ocean, which is warming up less rapidly than the rest of the planet. Now, global warming is real. It's going to happen. It's going to be big time. And some of the younger people here, they're going to live to see it. But because of our location, it's going to be slowed up. And so the effects over the next 20 years is probably going to be relatively minimal. And we probably have not seen too much of it yet. Okay, so that's the controversy here. So anyway, I think I'll end here with a little bit the hype of the media with snow, which is another topic I could get into, but I won't. Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to open up to some questions here. Yes, sir.
I don't know.
I mean, in the listings of stations, I don't know, this is somebody who works for me who puts the data together. One of the projects we have at the department is we get every single source of weather data in real time to the department, and then we put a lot of it up on the web. But
this is almost permanent.
Right, it is almost permanent, right, yeah. I'm not sure why it comes out that order.
Send me
an email if you want to change. Oh, well, Bellevue is different. I mean, it's not that far away, but for instance, Bellevue is wetter than Seattle. as an example. If you look at the precipitation map, it actually increases. So those of you who live in Woodinville, and if you live on this, you know, Sammamish, you know, plateau, you live up there, it's really getting wet. So there's definitely a gradient increasing towards the mountains. On the other hand, if you in Seattle, if you go north towards like Richmond Beach or up there, it's drying out because you're getting towards the rain shadow. Yes? I suspect that you're just noticing it more. There have been some studies in some places suggesting that there's some day of the week variation. What variation is apparent is during the day. The wettest time of the day is around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and the driest time of the day is around noon. And so I go running sometimes during the midday, and it's often dry then when it's raining earlier. So there is a diurnal change in rain. Yes. Oh, the cover picture? All right. I didn't pick that one out. In fact, the picture I wanted for the cover of the book is this one. Oh, this picture? Oh, okay. You said the cover picture of the book. Okay. Anyway, this picture was taken up in the Oregon Cascades. We had a field experiment there. And what you see here is some trees that have a lot of what we call rime icing on it. What happens is the clouds, a lot of times these clouds are super cooled. That means there's liquid water in the clouds that haven't frozen. You know, the water doesn't have to freeze at freezing. Water can stay liquid in clouds and be below freezing. And so when this stuff hits an object like trees, it freezes on. And that's what happened over there. It's called rime icing. This over here, I don't know, what is that, another tree? Another tree all iced up. Okay, let's see some more questions. Yes. Right. Well, there's some, you know, lightning bolts don't have to be hitting the ground. It can be inside the clouds as well. That's called cloud-to-cloud lightning.
Is there a name for that?
Cloud-to-cloud lightning. The technical term. Yes. Well, we don't get thunderstorms for two reasons. The number one thing rare thunderstorms like is a big change in temperature with height. Very warm near the surface, cooler aloft. Well, we don't get that warm near the surface, especially west of the mountains, because of this basically the air is relatively cool due to the ocean. The other thing is thunderstorms like moisture. Water vapor is a very important source of energy for them. We don't get very humid around here. We don't get a lot of moisture in the air here, right? Summers here are not humid, right? Why aren't the summers humid here, even though we're downstream of an ocean, right? Doesn't that seem strange? The reason is the ocean's too cold. The amount of water vapor air can hold, it can pick up, depends on its temperature. And so if you have air over cold ocean, it can't pick up that much moisture, even though it's in contact with water. On the other hand, people on the East Coast, that air is going over the Gulf of Mexico, which can be 80 degrees or whatever, right? That air can pick up a lot of moisture. So cool, too cool near the surface, and not enough water vapor. And that's why we don't get a lot of thunderstorms, unfortunately, for those of you like it. See. Yeah. All forecasting is going to get much better. And in fact, it has gotten much better. I mean, you know, people like to make fun of weathermen. And I have enough people making fun of me once in a while, like, you know, what kind of dice do you use and that kind of thing. But we've come a long way. For instance, every major windstorm recently, we've actually forecast pretty well. The Hanukkah Eve storm, you name it. But if you went back 20, 30 years, we got none of them right. Now, the reason the forecasts are getting better is the technology is improving. Faster computers let us go to higher and higher resolution and include more physics in our models. Also, we're getting more observations over the Pacific. You know, people talk about the Pacific being a data void. It's not anymore, because satellites are looking down from space and getting more and more information. So as these technologies are still improving, and then the next major revolution in forecasting is going to happen in the next 10 years, and that's probabilistic forecasting. No more telling you it's going to be a certain temperature tomorrow, but we'll give you probabilities of various temperatures. So there's a lot of things that are going to change. Maybe I'll do two more questions. Is that okay? And then, right. Now, there's a difference between snowpack and glaciers. The overall snowpack hasn't changed, but the glaciers are retreating, which is a very interesting twist on the whole thing. And it appears the reason is, several of us are working on this, is the wintertime temperatures are not warming up, but the summertime temperatures are. And the glaciers are very sensitive to that. So that's an interesting twist. So the snowpack isn't changing, but the glaciers do seem to be retreating. All the way up there.
Well, you're talking about South, where in South, I mean, it depends where you're talking about. I mean, the Andes do get precipitation, although some parts of the Andes are far enough south that they're in the subtropical zone where there's sinking air, where it's really relatively dry along the coastal zone. That's more like California. But if you go further south there towards Antarctica, they pick up precipitation. They're much more like us down there. It depends what latitude you're looking at. Okay, yes, one more question. Is China affecting our weather? Well, indirectly. They're putting out a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide and burning fossil fuels, so eventually they're going to affect our weather just in global warming. Occasionally, smoke and pollution from China comes over, and we can actually see it on the satellite photographs. You can actually see there have actually been air quality alerts here in Seattle due to pollution from China. So when you say affect the weather, I mean, it's certainly affecting the weather in that way. Maybe one more question, what the hell? Yeah. Well, it depends what kind of clouds. Some clouds are uniform, but others are broken up, and that's due to the fact you have instability that develops at certain layers in the atmosphere, and you have these circulations where you have rising motion and then sinking motion in the periphery. There's other types of circulations that are sort of like waves in the atmosphere, and that can produce areas of clouds and no clouds. So there's various types of physical mechanisms that can break up the cloud deck. Okay, I think I'll stop there. Yeah? Thank you.
This program was presented by the Seattle Public Library. It was made possible by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. The Library Foundation represents thousands of people in our community who make gifts, large and small, to help us buy books and materials for the collections, to present free public programs, to provide programs and services for Seattle's immigrant and refugee community, and to support early learning so that children are ready for school. For more information on these podcasts, please visit our website, www.spl.org.